Oh, I can touch your hand. I can feel the warmth of your hand in my phantom hand.
Hi, I'm Alex, and welcome to the X-Health Show, where I talk to visionaries behind the latest innovations in healthcare for the extra health of the future. We're at EPFL Geneva branch on Campus Biotech, where neurobiology meets technology. Dr. Soleiman Shokour is a neuroengineer and a scientist who's worked on some real cool stuff. Brain-computer interfaces, is friends with Neuralink, was involved in a mind-controlled robotic exoskeleton featured at the 2014 World Cup. He moved into restoring sensory motor functions, haptics, and now with a Swiss-Italian team, he works on a new bionic technology called Minitouch. It allows a person with an amputated hand to feel hot and cold in their phantom hand. Also, he's comfortable speaking in five languages. But today you'll hear about how people with no hand can feel warmth in a hand they do not have, why you don't really feel wetness, bionic hands and robotic hands. Soleiman, what did Fabrizio say after he used the hand augmented by your team?
Well, his first reaction, let's say, was a very professional one because he was part of this experiment where we tried to use to give thermal feedback for amputees. And he had to discriminate between different temperatures and he was really focused on the experiment, let's say. He was really good at it, actually. He was quite focused. He's somebody who's participated to many other experiments. He's somebody who's giving a lot of his time also for research. So he was good at it. And then we had another experiment in which he had to discriminate between different materials, also pretty good. And then there was a moment a bit more relaxed and where we just stopped doing the experiment and we were playing around with the system. And one of our researchers, Jonathan, who's the first author of the study, he took the sensor and placed it on his own arm just to warm up a little bit the system. And that was the first real genuine experience of Fabrizio. It was like, oh, I can touch your hand. Okay. I can feel the warmth of your hand in my phantom hand. That's really cool. And then we started digging into that. It's like, okay, the things you guys do with the material and all of that, okay, that's fun, that's fine. But this thing, now I can feel his hand. This is really, really nice. Oh. So that's, for me, was his first reaction, while the rest of it was also part of the experiment we were running, seriously trying to see if it was really working. So it was, let's say, in two steps reaction, yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. Could you tell a bit more about Fabrizio? Because like you already said, he's like a professional pilot or tester, right?
Yes. That's I think you would like that. So he's a gentleman from Pistoia. This is in Italy. All the participants to the study that we did are from Italy, and I will tell you a bit more in a minute. He had his amputation, I think, 40 years ago in 85, if I'm not mistaken. And it is a work-related amputation. And this is for all the participants we work with, because we work with a center called INAIL, where we do our research.
That's in Italy.
In Italy, exactly, close to Bologna, which is a very interesting place, by the way. It is a center, an orthopedic center, which helps people who had work-related accidents, both to for their daily needs, for their prostheses, to, I don't know if there's a screw that is a bit broken, that they will come and do it there. But at the same time, they propose them to participate to cutting-edge scientific experiments. So if there's a new super nice robotic hand that comes there, that is on the market, the main, let's say, researcher, his name is Emanuele Gruppioni. He's the one leading a research group inside this orthopedic center. He will offer the participant or the patients to test it.
So that's how Fabrizio was recruited.
Exactly. That's, and he has been recruited to many other of, I mean, he has given of his time for many other things. And it was funny because, as you said, I really like that expression of a professional tester, because when he came, it was a bit in this mindset, okay, guys, bring it on. I have seen many of these experiments. I'm going to do it. And I'm going to do it in a good way because I think this is important for future prosthetic users, until that real moment where suddenly he was like, oh, this is different. And after that, he came to several of our tests. So he's the one that we followed for the longest. We tested 11 times with him for over 2 years. Going back on your question, it is a work-related accident. It's something that is still very painful for him, something that he doesn't go in great detail. It looks like he was really the wrong person in the wrong moment, in the wrong place, something that he was not supposed to, it was not, it was mismanagement, let's say, of resources, where he ended up using a machine that he should not have used. So something that is extremely painful for him, but he sees the hope of improving his condition and condition of other people's by participating, also by giving very generously his time for experiments.
So do you know if this is still very prevalent, so like work-related accidents for, well, hand injuries or like that end up basically with hand amputation?
It is fairly common among the upper limb amputees, specifically in region of high industrialization like north of Italy. And I mean, probably depends a lot by countries. In other places, I mean, in war zones, myself from Afghanistan originally, so this is a very common also condition in war zones for soldiers and for civilians. Other causes could be fireworks, for example, bad use of fireworks. That's something we have seen among our participants. Accidents, car accidents are unfortunately also one of the causes. Yes, that would be the main causes for.
Mm-hmm. We have the prosthetic hand on the table, equipped with the sensors that you developed. Could you describe basically what Fabrizio had attached to his body and how? You gave it to me, right? Mm-hmm. And it's pretty heavy, right? So could you say, like, what does it consist of, please?
Sure. So the first part, the simple part, is this plastic-ish thing, which is the socket. It's what fixes the prosthesis to the stump, to the residual arm. This is made by orthopedist, and this is made, let's say, they do 3D models of the stump, and it is something that is very personalized for every subject. Because this is, I mean, is the part is going to be in contact with the skin, so this is very, let's say, mechanical.
What's it
issues.
Made of? Or is it like this 3D printed thing?
The inner layer, they do it personalized. The outer layer here, it's a harder one. This is more standard. Mm. But the inside one, yes, it is printed for... specifically for every subject, yeah. And actually, this is one that was the one that Fabrizio used in the experiments. Now, so you have the socket, let's say. This is the mechanical part.
Just one thing, guys, because we basically have here like a hand, you know, like yes. lying in front of us, right? With some cables attached and some other stuff attached. But it's like, you know, a hand like from the elbow down to the hand.
Exactly. It is, yeah. So the people we work with, they are transradial amputees. So they have the elbow. So there's no motor, let's say, on the elbow part. There is really just the hand and then this big fixation thing. Now, I want also to clarify that the hand... The sockets and the robotic hand, they are standard ones. So they are the one that patients, it's made by Ottobock, is really one of the most common one that is robotic hand, let's say.
Yeah, so you just mentioned Ottobock, which is like a manufacturer of prosthetics. Right?
Yes, one of the really big players there. So the participant to our experiment, they come with their own prosthesis. And this is one of them. This is one a spare one, so that's why we could leave it in the lab here. Generally, by the way, the patients, they have more than one hand, because if one of them breaks... while the one is being repaired, they have the second one.
Oh.
So this is why we could play with one of the spare ones here. So socket, first part, the mechanical part. Second comes the robotic hand, which is then fixed here to the socket. So this is the part of the hand that will move. So this one has a passive wrist. So the wrist, you have to move it yourself with your other hand. And it has active grasping. So the patient could control two different kinds of grasps. How is it controlled? It's through electromyography, or let's say activation of muscles, which are electrodes placed inside the socket, which records the activation of the muscle of the subject. So when he contracts his arm, that opens the hand. To put
above
it
the elbow, that is, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Around the amputated part. He has still a few muscles there. So if he contracts, he will open it. If he contracts twice, he's going to close.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of thing. So this is also, let's say, commonly used now. Now, on top of it comes our system, which is made of a sensor, which we call the active thermal sensor, which I could describe to you if you want in more detail, which measures the temperature at the fingertip of the prosthesis, but also mimics the thermal properties of the finger.
It looks like kind of a chip, or is it...
It does look like that. It's just really more the shape that we sort of optimize the shape of the sensor to take the largest area and at the same time not having too much material. It's really just for that. Now, this sensor measures the temperature there. We have a controller which then mediates the temperature to another element that is called a Peltier element. What the Peltier element does, it's a little electronic element which can cool down or warm up. warming up is simple. You can do it with a resistance. That's not complicated. But cooling down is very complicated. So you need a Peltier element which allows to cool down the skin at the temperature you want. And practically what we do is that we bring the temperature of the skin at the residual arm, so at the cutted part, at the same temperature as what it was at the what was measured at the fingertip of the prosthesis. We see commercially available prosthesis enhanced, or let's say augmented, with this electronic. We had to make a hole in the sockets. This was done by the orthopedic team that worked with us in Bologna. Relatively simple. We just place it there and then we put a few screws so we make sure that it's always, the Peltier element is always in contact with the skin. We can adjust that because there could be a little bit of swelling also, like on the skin. So we make sure of that.
And there's just one thing. So it is like a working prototype, right? Because we're still at the university, mm-hmm. right? So it is not something that's a commercially available, or, you know, we're like before that, right?
We are way before that. This is prototype 2.1.
Okay.
Yes. I will not show you the 1.0 because it really looks ugly. And now we are going into, we have a 2.2, which will be smaller. Let's say the ugliest part right now, the one I like the least, the team we like the least, is this heatsink here, which, so what happens is that if we cool down the skin, then we need to extract that heat somewhere. So this is almost like those computer heatsinks.
Okay.
Which just extracts the heat. We didn't want to put a fan. We didn't want to have an active thing with sound. That would have been a simple solution, but we didn't like that. So this, we are working with more smart materials to make it more flat. Because obviously, if you wear that and then you put your shirt on, that's going to look ugly.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's very much a prototype.
Okay, so how does it work then? If we could go one step back, and how does this... Is it robotic or is it bionic, this arm?
Is it bionic? Okay.
You so mentioned robotic bionic? Hands, right?
It is a robotic hand, exactly. We call it a thermal robotic hand. So what is bionic? Bionic is it's a blend word, right? It's in French, we call Movalis, suitcase word. it's biology and electronics. So anything that links the two is bionic. In a sense, the fact that it records the muscle activity, the electrical muscle activity to control the hand, it's already a bionic hand.
Mm-hmm.
On the temperature side, we could say also it is a bionic sensory feedback because our thermode is in contact in surface, not implanted, but is in contact with the nerves. So we convey the information to the nervous system through our thermode. So yes, it is a prosthetic hand and a bionic hand. Yeah, you can call it a bionic hand.
All right. There is something also called neuroprosthetics. Is it also the one that we have here?
Yes. A neuroprosthetic, it's, let's say, a subset of bionics, which specifically interfaces with the nervous system. So it is a neuroprosthetic, yes.
So now, how does it work? So we have it, or that Fabrizio had it attached to his... But is it like he puts it on just like that?
Yes.
And then, okay. And then what happens?
So maybe I can explain to you first, why is it that it works?
Okay.
Or what makes it work? Because there is, it's the study here is two things. It's sort of a scientific discovery and a technological development that made it. A relatively simple solution at the end made it quite effective. The first part of that made this possible was finding what we called phantom thermal sensations. What we found is that on the residual arm or the stump of the patients, of the amputees, there are some specific spots, and you have to sort of search for that. You have to map personalize for everyone. There are some specific spots which, when thermally stimulated, say simply if you warm up or cool down those specific spots, they trigger a thermal sensation in their phantom hand. So we cool down the skin at the forearm, and for a very long time, we really thought that they will feel it just at the forearm. What we found is that there are some spots that suddenly give a sensation, not anymore on the arm, but in the missing hand, in the phantom hand.
We'll be right back. This episode is brought to you by The Exhale Show and me, Alex. If you still haven't, please hit follow at the top. That'll help me bring more of these visionaries to you. Thanks a lot. Stay awesome now. Back to the episode. Okay, but you're speaking now, not the hand that is attached, but the missing hand, really. So the hand that is not there.
Exactly.
Okay.
The
So this is what comes with, for example, phantom pain. Right?
Exactly. The mechanism is similar in that sense, but it's not a painful sensation. It is a thermal sensation.
Okay, so you don't have a hand, but you feel cold in your fingers that you don't have.
Exactly. And that came to some extent as a surprise to us, because our first idea was really to convey the temperature from the fingertip to some other part of the body. And we said that we can put it even on the shoulder, so the subject can know if it's touching something hot or cold, and he or she will feel it on the shoulder. While we were searching for a best spot on the residual arm, and we start doing some mapping, we start having more and more of responses by the patient saying, wait, no, I feel it there. I was like, point me. Why? What do you mean there? And no, here. Like they were pointing in the air somewhere where the hand doesn't exist. We knew from the literature that tactile phantom sensations exist, non-painful tactile. So if you come mechanically and you touch with a pen to some parts, that sometimes induces or triggers a tactile sensation. We didn't know that thermal sensations exist, that they were quite common. We tested 27 patients, and on 17 of them, we found reliable phantom thermal sensations, so about more than half, about 60% of them, and that they were functional. I mean, hot is hot, cold is cold. Going from cold to hot, to hot, the dynamic temperature is hot, because it could have been also just an illusion, right? Just a transient illusion. But no, it was something that is functional, that could give you a continuous sensation of temperature of what you're touching. Or even in one of the tests, they could detect if they were touching metal or plastic, going through giving the thermal properties of the materials, which is a very subtle, small thermal difference. Even that was possible in the phantom hand. So this phantom hand is quite functional, let's say, in that sense.
Well, does it depend on like how long ago the hand was amputated? Because Fabrizio, thank you very much. If you're listening to it, thank you very much for
grazie
your
mille,
work.
Fabrizio, grazie.
So you mentioned that his hand was amputated 40 years ago, mm-hmm. and he still has that.
Yes.
Okay.
It's a very good point. We checked for, let's say, markers of why some people have and some people don't have the phantom thermal sensation. Because as I said, 62%, if you do, have the sensation. That means that the rest, they don't. And we tried to look at what was a predictor of that. So times since the amputation was not. Completely unrelated with that. Lengths of amputation, we guessed if it's something that is, if the stump is a little bit longer, closer, let's say, to the wrist or closer to the elbow, it would be different. No relation. Male-female, no relation. Skin temperature, baseline skin temperature, we said, okay, maybe because maybe you and I, we have 3 to 4 degrees difference right. in our hand, because there are big differences in population.
3 to 4, okay, we'll come back to that.
No, the hand is actually very different temperatures. So we wonder if it had to do with that, and it didn't. So we don't know precisely what it is. What we think, and that's talking with surgeons, and we are actually studying that, it looks like that once the amputation is done, the nerves, they grow in a somehow random way into the skin. And what we believe is that chaotic regrowth of the nerve after the amputation into the skin, that's what decides if some have phantom sensation or not. And there might be ways to optimize that sensation.
I'm just thinking, because we already had on the show the neurostimulation of the penile area, so to treat erectile dysfunction. And this is actually what their job was, to basically teach the nerves to work as they used to mm-hmm. work, right?
Yes.
So this chaotic thing, this chaotic regrowth, as you describe it, or you probably would use, you know, better words to describe it, is something that you, there's another thing you can train them, probably.
Absolutely. It's possible to change that. It's also possible surgically to change that. There's a procedure called targeted muscle or targeted sensory reinnervation done by Professor Kukian, for example, in Chicago, which it's mainly taking the nerves from amputees from some confusing regions to some other more accessible regions. So it's possible that also for those that did not feel it, that if you do those sort of, if we find that it's clinically extremely important to give thermal feedback, which is something that we are also working on, then it could also make sense maybe to intervene surgically. And it looks like this targeted muscle and sensory innervation is not something that is incredibly complicated to do, to also facilitate for them, yes.
Why was Fabrizio that much in awe when he felt the warmth of your colleague's hand.
Why? So it's a good point. That's
another way of asking, yes, like, why this is important, basically, to feel the warmth or the temperature.
So temperature, it's very much linked with affective aspect of touch. The hedonic aspect of contact comes a lot with temperature. We looked at it from a functional point of view because we are, again, once again, engineers. So for us, we say, okay, temperature conveys if my cup is super hot or is dangerously hot. It also conveys information about material because I can recognize it through the thermal properties. It could also convey humidity, for example, something I'm particularly interested in. All of this is functional. And all of that is true, and it's very important. So to answer to your question, it has a functional aspect to that.
So I can imagine grabbing a beer and you know if it's cold or not.
Yes, absolutely. Exactly. And it's very important. It's very much important, exactly. But then there's the second aspect, which is which we did not anticipate, which is the social aspect of thermal feedback in when you touch. So when you touch somebody or you touch something, the tactile information is, we'd really touch something that has only a tactile information. It's always a thermotactile information. And again, looking a bit more from an historical point of view, our field, the neuroengineering field, has been working for at least 20 years now on trying to restore tactile feedback. Try to give the sensation of pressure, of different textures, and with a lot of success and a lot of really, really interesting things going on. People were next on proprioception, so knowing where the finger is, which is also very important from a motor aspect. Now, adding temperature adds an extra dimension to that. And that dimension could be this more affective part of it. So to answer why is it important, it is functionally important. It has a social aspect to that. And for Fabrizio, it was maybe more the real surprise of feeling something that he never felt since his amputation, and never felt also in any of the other experiments that he had gone through.
So it's, I think this, we could speak about the, you know, how the handshake works, right? So this is how we greeted each other today, right?
Yes.
Through the handshake.
Absolutely.
And there is like a science behind it also, right? Why this is important. And how does this really makes people closer, right? Mm-hmm. Or like more social, right? How did you test? So you had this hypothesis that, you know, temperature is important, and you knew you are engineers, so mm-hmm. you build a model, right? Mm-hmm. How did you test that this really works for amputees, for people who have amputated arms?
Mm-hmm. I want to just be a little bit more humble in our first hypothesis. Our hypothesis is that it was interesting for us. Mm-hmm. Important is really for the patients then to tell how they feel it is important or not. For myself, I was interested to see if it's possible to give a natural sensation. So something that feels as the intact hand. And that was a real interesting scientific question for me. If we create that sensation, so once we start seeing this phantom thermal sensation, I think there was really a point there. Up to there, we were really only thinking in terms of engineering. After that, we start thinking also in terms of some other scientific questions there. And once we had that, the question for me was, is it phenomenologically similar to the intact hand? Is it stable? So do you feel the same way from one day to the other? So we did several days of that. Okay, so how we test it is very tricky. Because once we talk about subjective sensations, I'm always afraid that the participant tells me what they think I want to hear. So once we had this phantom thermal sensations, if you go to the next subject and you say, do you feel phantom thermal sensation? Is it nice? They will probably say yes, mm-hmm. because they feel, they see you came all the way from Switzerland to do it, so they would tell you yes. So the goal there was really try to see and quote unquote, if they cheat in their answer. So try to really test it in such a way with control experiments, try to really randomize it, hide all the parameters and try to see what they could exactly feel. So for example, one of the tests we did on the perception is that we would simulate a certain sensation on their phantom hand. For example, we simulated the sensation of touching metal, and we would come on the other hand, the mirror hand, on the intact one, and come touch with another piece of material. So for example, we simulate on the phantom hand copper, and then we come on the physical one and we come with a piece of plastic. And we ask the subject, eyes closed, does it feel the same or not? Hmm. So then they don't know at all what is going on. They are never told which one is which and what's going on. And they could potentially say it doesn't feel the same. I mean, it's really that random. And there we could see that if we give the right temperature drop on the phantom hand with the right physical one, they were significantly higher. So then you do the statistic, blah, blah. And then you say, okay, now 90% of the time he's telling me it feels the same. If I twist or change a little bit, he tells me it doesn't feel the same. He's probably not cheating.
How is the temperature difference? Because you said like you're changing temperature. How do you do that?
So on our system, the MiniTouch, we can control quite precisely the surface of the part that is in contact with the skin. We also close the loop on the skin itself. So we can control not only the, let me put it in easier words. We don't control our system, we control the temperature of the skin. So we bring the skin to the right temperature as if it was touching this piece of material. So for example, my finger is probably at 32 degrees. The room here, we must be at 23 degrees. If I touch a piece of metal, my finger will go to 26. If I touch a piece of plastic, my finger will go to 28. It will cool down
a
bit less.
So fascinating.
It just cools down my finger physically, right? Oh. So if I cool down your finger with the same temperature drop, the same way, I could give the illusion of touching this material.
So it's not that you are giving like any like ice or something. It's just the material that actually cools the hand down or like the surface of the skin down.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It conveys the temperature faster. Metal will do it faster than plastic. And that's all what it is.
Okay. Now, I want to go back to something that you already mentioned that, you know, the differences in people's hands temperature can be 3 to 4 degrees. How do you start from that? So you start with measuring individual temperatures and like, how do you even measure that surface, you know?
It's yes. I mean, that's the tricky part with temperature. And coming, for example, I worked for a very long time on tactile feedback, and tactile feedback is somehow similar in everyone. Temperature has a lot more in that. And the baseline temperature of the body is very different. So we measure it first, the baseline temperature for 10 minutes. We come with a simple laser measurements, really like the one that you maybe even have at home. At least I know engineers generally have that at home. We like to have those sort of toys. Maybe not everyone likes to have it. But so we measure that and then we fix the baseline temperature to that. And that baseline temperature is also personalized. So it's 30 degrees for someone, it's maybe 33 degrees for somebody else. And our sensor, the one that's here that comes on the fingertip of the prosthesis, will also bring the surface of the sensor would be at the skin temperature of the participant.
So do you need to set it or is it?
Yes.
Okay.
We set that also to the same. So now if the subject has a 33 degree, now my sensor is also at 33 degree. So when this sensor touches an object, the thermal drop would be similar to the intact hand of the subject.
How do you feel temperature? I mean, okay, guys, I'm asking all these questions because actually Solomon told me that he can speak hours about temperature. So, I mean, we've got here like an expert in temperature and this is our chance basically to learn as much as we can about temperature.
And I wish I could call myself an expert in temperature because really my colleagues, physiologists in temperature, they could speak for a whole day and I could be listening to them for a whole day and I learn from them. So we have receptors in the skin for many sort of modalities. So if you look at the skin of the, let's say, our fingertip here, and then we look at the receptors there, we have mechanoreceptors for touch, we have for vibration, we have for indentation, and there are different little receptors there with different, let's say, density depending of the body. That's why we are more sensitive on the fingertip for touch than on the back, for example. So different modalities for different kind of mechanical sensations, different densities, different response times. And then we also have specific receptors for temperature. We have specific ones for cold and for hot. So cold and hot, we feel it with different receptors. And then once, and this is for the non-painful range of temperature, about 18 degrees to 40 degrees. If you go above that, you go into painful one, and that's a whole different history there. So it's very complicated because there are many different kind of receptors. They respond to different temperatures.
You could have different temperatures for different. Different receptors for different temperatures. Is that
for
what
different
you're
ranges? For hot or cold, excuse me. And they convey also in different speeds because you feel something cold much faster. You feel it relatively fast actually, but something hot you feel it much slower. We have fewer of them, and they are 10 to 20 times slower, for example, than touch.
So that's how we can burn ourselves much easier, right? Or is it?
Except that burn has a little extra thing, is that once you go into painful one, then you have nociception kicking in, and that is actually relatively quick.
Oh, okay.
You can, if I can come with a lamp, let's say a contactless temperature, and then I slowly warm up part of your skin, that it will take you a bit of time for you to notice that approach the lamp. Burning might be a bit faster because you have that kicking in there. But then it's also funny because when you go in very, very hot, then sometimes you also have the cold receptors responding. It's complex. It's different for hot and cold. It's very different for very hot and very cold. We stay in this non-painful zone. And on top of it, we have this extra thing, which is now we have nerves that were severed that regrow into skin, and we are trying to target those ones with the amputees. So it's extra complication.
How does touching different materials affect our fingertip temperature? So this is what you mentioned before,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Metal is different than plastic. What are the differences?
The differences are in the, let's say, setting point of the temperature. So let's say, once again, if you go from 32 degrees for metal, it will bring you maybe to 26 degrees, but also how fast it will go to that temperature. Now, we cannot, let's say, detect an infinite amount of materials. I mean, it's not like vision. We are not as good as with vision. But there are some tests, and that's done now a lot in haptics for virtual reality games, where they are trying to play with this kind of things. We try to also to merge a little bit neuroengineering with the haptics field. We started going in their conferences because they know much more about this kind of things.
And we also had haptics on the show already.
Excellent. And it's there are fields that we don't necessarily communicate too much. And we started going in those conferences. We started going more into thermal comfort conferences. There's a whole science about that we naturally don't really know about too much. And in haptics, so there are studies up to, if I'm not mistaken, 8 different materials. So let's say ceramic, aluminium, plastic. So you can go for a bunch of them. I mean, I don't know if you could go for 20 different materials to do it. But then also, at some point, it becomes also thermotactile, because so far we keep talking about thermal, right? And we did only thermal in this study because it was something we never did before. But we did tactile for a very long time. So it's now time actually to put them together, because maybe with thermal you can discriminate 8 objects, with tactile you can discriminate 20, but the sum of the two, you can probably discriminate everything around us.
Yeah, and so, there are already available some prosthetics with this tactile elements in them so that people can actually feel someone else's face. So like the softness, for example,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The tactile field has progressed much more. There are some new companies now that really their selling point is the fact that they give tactile feedback. There is a few of them that are being quite successful on providing tactile feedback. And what we say is that to these people doing that, at temperature, it is, the analogy is, there's one I really like from one of our colleagues. Her name is Rochelle Akerley. She's one of the world experts about affective touch. She actually discovered the mechanism in the skin for that. She's in Marseille. So she says, and I'm going to just steal her quote, is touch without temperature is like vision without color. Hmm. And I think the analogy is nice because it is an extra dimension to your vision. This will add this extra dimension to that. You can do everything that people were already doing with tactile, pressure, texture, and add this element and just increase the palette of sensations.
Soleiman, can I just ask you now, like, how did you actually end up with this temperature? Because now you've been working on it for like, what 5-10 years?
No, less than that, 4 years. Hmm. 4 years on specifically temperature. Much longer on sensory feedback as a general sort of subject. And much longer, or not much longer, maybe it's 15 years that I'm working in restoring sensory and motor functions for people with deficiencies. I worked in the past more on people with lower limb deficiencies, so with paraplegic patients.
So spine injuries.
Spine injuries, particularly, exactly. On the motor side, so how to restore motor functions. But let's say my little add-on always in the field has been more on the sensory part. On the motor part, I've been working with colleagues it was part of my PhD also. But I've always been more interested into the sensory aspect to that because I think it's, first, it's important for experiencing the world around us, but it's also important for the motor part. So actually, if you want to reach a certain level of dexterity, you cannot just, quote unquote, concentrate on motor. You need to also bring sensory feedback. And there are clinical conditions, for example, for people who loses tactile sensation in their hands. And if you and I will look at them, let's say non-expert clinician, non-clinicians, you will have the impression that they have a motor deficiency, because actually the lack of sensation brings a level of motor deficiencies. And here we are, like, as engineers, working a lot on the motor part, and I was feeling that the sensory part was little studied. So I worked for quite some time on sensory feedback restoration for paraplegics, for giving them the sensation of when their foot was touching the floor. They used robotic devices to walk, and then they had to look at the legs to know where the legs were. And
yeah,
and
this is something like I also, when I was preparing, you know, for this episode, that's the thing that differentiate when you can feel or you cannot feel, that when you want to grab something with your robotic arm, you need to look closely at your hand at all times to basically place the robotic arm where it should be. While when you do it with your hand, well, your hand that you have, right? Mm-hmm. You basically look once, and then you may look away, and you'll still grab the mug. Right.
Absolutely. And you describe it perfectly, because it's exactly what happens. You look at the object, you prepare the motor actions, and then you can start thinking about something else or do something else. And then the rest of it is the tactile or the sensory pathways that tells you, now I'm in contact with the cup. Now I need to squeeze more because I'm going to maybe break it, or maybe it's a plastic cup and I didn't notice. And then suddenly I need to, or maybe the cup was full of water and I didn't notice and I need to grab more. So all of that it's tactile. So I've been working on that for some time, and I entered more into the bionic hand field in 2019. Again, first working on all sort of sensory feedback in tactile. And then slowly we started discovering this effects on thermal, and we started digging more into that.
What were the discoveries?
The discovery was really this phantom thermal sensation. I think that's where we started thinking that we could dig much more into that. Before that was talking with some of my colleagues in haptics, and what I noticed also, that for them, let's say, again, in the virtual reality world, or people working in haptics, they were asking themselves the question of temperature since much longer in terms of palette of sensations. And we were not, like, people in neuroengineering, we were not really interested in that. It was, let's say, it was that, you know, that subject that always comes up in the discussion section of the paper, saying, it would be potentially interesting to also give temperature. But it seemed to be, I think it was for quite some time, seemed to be, an easy problem to solve at some point. And once we started digging, we noticed that there is more to that than what we maybe originally thought.
We'll be right back. I want to say thank you for listening to this episode. If you find it interesting and feel particularly generous today, leave a review, hit this star rating. I'll be able to continue with the X-Health show for you. 3, 2, 1, and back to the episode. And then, okay, so you described how does it work with the human hand, or like the human fingertips, mm-hmm. like how do they feel that, these receptors. Now, how did you approach working on a sensor, like an external sensor that would work the same? I mean, bionic seems like, you know, you want to mimic that, what we have in the skin, how did you really start with that?
It was really much of an iteration in our team. We had three quite fantastic master students working on this. At some point, it became quite popular as a subject. So we had good students from EPFL coming. And our first setup was a simple thermometer sensor, so something that would just measure. And we were seeing that something was missing there. Like something was it would work if you touch something super hot, but it would not work for any more subtle sensation. So we started going to more biomimetic approaches, and that's where we developed this active thermal sensor. So what we have is we have a thin film here that first brings the temperature of the sensor itself at 32 degrees. So at constant power, we give a constant power to that. We played a little bit more on the materials that comes here, the thickness of the material, the shape and all of that. So we find a geometry in a material which, when at constant power, gives us always 32 degrees. And what you have here is actually interlaced a warming element and a thermal sensor. So the idea is not that complicated than that. It's a thermal sensor interlaced with a warming element.
What could it be used for?
The fact of giving thermal feedback.
Right.
So as we mentioned here and there, to know the temperature of an object, that's easy answer. To know the material of the object you're touching to that, it's a bit more subtle. To know interaction with other humans, so recognize if you're touching a fake hand, you're touching a real hand, you're touching a cold hand, etc. And then another element, another modality we didn't speak about, which we also discovered throughout time and we started digging into that, it's on humidity detection. So we, as humans, we don't have humidity sensors in our skin.
Right. You said that to me before. Like, we can't feel wet. Is that what you're saying?
We can feel wet.
But we don't feel an illusion.
Exactly. To an illusion. Absolutely. It's a complete illusion. We don't have like specific receptors for that. And some insects, for example, they have that. We don't have it. So we rely on some mechanical aspect of touch. So a wet surface will be a bit more smoother. The viscosity could change a little bit. But we rely a lot, actually a lot more, in the thermal properties. So a wet up surface will cool down my skin in a certain way. And actually you can even do the test.
Well, this is how sweat works, right?
Exactly, yes. Well, sweat makes you also colder, exactly. Mm. But you could also, so if you do the test, I don't know if you sit on a cold bench when you go skiing, your first reaction is you have the impression that you sat on something wet. You have the impression that it was it snow? Was it actually just cold? And it's actually very hard to discriminate between the two. So if you cool down the skin the proper way, you could give an illusion, a quite vivid illusion that you're touching something wet.
Wow. Okay. What did your tests say?
Our tests say that we tested first with non-amputated people for quite some time. We spent 2 years with that. And there we had super nice students that came more from physiology working with us. And we checked actually with a number of students and other naive subjects. Eyes closed, we will cool down their skin in a certain way. So quick drop with some proper parameters. And we asked them how it felt. And you see that actually there is a sweet spot somewhere around -7 degrees compared to the baseline temperature, where they have the illusion that something wet has been touching their skin. So their skin is wet.
Okay. Does it stay?
It stays the time of the stimulation. So we checked it up to 10 seconds and it stays 10 seconds. And it's the illusion is strong enough that when at the end of the experiment, we were telling them that at no point we touched with something wet, they barely believed us. Like it was wet.
What would they say it in your face? Like,
absolutely.
You're lying.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, we are good liars because we also had a few sponges with water somewhere in the room. So they could have thought it also, let's say, but we say we actually never touched it with that thing. It was in the room, but we never did it. We always did with a cold surface. And so we found first the parameters for that. We found that it was, let's say, between 5 and 7 degrees. We found how long it was. We found which part of the body does it. And once we knew that, we integrated the same thing into the prosthesis. So we did another test also on wetness, which we published earlier this year. And there, the test was done with two amputees. Fabrizio was also, again, participating to that. Different samples with different levels of moisture. Surprisingly hard to do. Different levels of moisture because of evaporation. So make sure that two samples have the same level of moisture. It was a whole engineering complex task to do. But we had that, and he was scanning them, eyes closed, and had to say what was the level of moisture of that. And what we found is that he was as good with our system that he was with his intact hand.
Oh, that's amazing.
So same level.
Mm-hmm.
We had a second gentleman who, and then, excuse me, we did another thing. We turned off the thermal feedback. And then we asked the guy to, Fabrizio to scan. And we said, okay, is the viscosity enough to know? Fabrizio, no. He had 4 levels. He was a chance level. Like really was 25% of the time correct, 75% wrong. So he was shooting by chance. But we had one gentleman that even without temperature, he was able at 50%. And I'm like, okay, that's more than chance level. How is that possible? And we found that he works at COP in Italy and he holds, so he's an amputee. He holds boxes. So he has to know if the box that he's holding is wet or not, because then that could fall. So he has sort of integrated some way the viscosity or the slipperiness, let's say, of the object, even without temperature. But he sort of created his own sensation.
So he trained himself, like he trained his brain. He trained, like, what did he train really?
I think it's unconscious. Like it's that is like probably on his daily basis, he sees that happening and his brain is trained to perceive that. Now, to be mentioned that this second participant, 50% without temperature, he reached then 85% with temperature. So he also boosted his sensation to have the temperature, but he was able to find some different ways to do it. So which was I think also funny to interesting to look.
Awesome. Now, could you tell a bit more about the team that works on this project? Because it's an international project. That's one thing, right?
Yes.
Who's involved in that? And like, what kind of expertise is needed? What you were actually joining on the way? So like when there was a need, mm-hmm. and you were like, oh, we need someone who knows something about that. You know, yeah. Could you tell a bit more about the team and the process, you know, of gathering the team?
Sure. It sounds now a bit like the superhero things in which we gather teams with different things.
The Lord of the Rings.
I like it a lot. Yes. So it is a project that is led by three centers. First, EPFL. So we are the Translational Neural Engineering Lab at EPFL. Second, the university, the Scuola Sant'Anna Superiore in Pisa, which is another neuroengineering center and bioengineering center. And the third is the INAIL center that I told you a bit before, which is this clinic in Bologna. So the three teams really worked pretty much the whole time together on this project. Now, in terms of expertise, or going more into the people that work on that, Francesco Iberite, he's a PhD student in Pisa who has been really there since the beginning. Jonathan, he's joined us as a PhD. He's also an engineer in electronic. He's the one who developed the sensors, the thermal device. We had other people. Utman, he's one of our other PhDs who worked specifically on the different materials that comes in the sensor. So we had also some material engineering people. We had more experimental science people that in Budrio that helped us also design some of the experiments. Try to think of the other expertise. Oh yeah, and then we helped. So for the whole wetness project, we were super lucky to find this world expert of wetness. His name is Davide Filingieri. He's a professor at Southampton. And we contacted him and really the contact was super easy and he always helped us. And he's really has made all his career in perception of wetness. He's made his career in many different things, but he's really an expert in that. And he helped us on finding those parameters that gives you the wetness illusion. So yes, the expertise were both in physiology, experimentation, neuroengineering, electronic, material engineering, and prosthetics in general.
Now, where are you going with that project now? I can imagine, you know, people listening to it might be asking themselves like, you know, so where or when could I, you know, actually have it, you know, in my robotic arm?
We hope as soon as possible, honestly. It's a fairly simple technology, and I hope that I managed to explain that through our discussion. It's once we know that phantom thermal sensation exists, once we have developed this active thermal sensor and the rest of it is simple. So let's say from a translation to a product is not that complicated. It's also cheap electronic. It's maybe a few hundred dollars. So it becomes a question from the industrial partners when they are joining us into that.
Okay, so you created this mini touch and now you're looking for partners that could help you commercialize it.
Exactly. We have a few steps before a commercialization. We have at least one step, which is trying it outside the laboratory. Like so far, we tried it in controlled environments and we want to try it in a slightly longer experiment, which is on the way, by the way, and this is one of the tests that we are doing.
And this is, guys, you know, because actually Solomon told me about it, you know, before we started recording. So behind my back, there is this whiteboard when he actually, you know, that there is a drawing of a person in this like thermal suit or like, what is it? And there are like a lot of, you know, questions or stages. Yeah. Could you actually tell about that? Like, what do you want to test there?
We want to really do the stress test on this as much as possible. We want to check how it works in different ambient temperatures. And we have some partners that will help us also in testing it in different environments. So super hot environment, super cold environment, humidity, etc. We want also to check how it influences on the long term some of the very crucial issues linked to temperature, or excuse me, some of unsolved issues in amputees. And I will name two of them. First is phantom limb pain, which you mentioned before. It's something that is very common in amputees. So they have this really bad pain in their missing hand, which is known to come from sort of discrepancy between the motor and the sensory feedback. So the lack of sensory feedback believed to be one of the reasons for the appearance of phantom limb pain.
Yeah, because the brain recognizes there's something wrong going on. So like
exactly.
That the arm must be twisted or like...
Exactly.
It
goes... there is a registered almost... impossible position of the hand or like really painful positions. And it has been shown by other groups, including also ours, that adding sensory feedback in a prosthesis reduces significantly phantom limb pain. And that could be another good reason to add sensory feedback, the functional part, the affective part, the phantom limb pain. And we believe that it's also, there are good reasons, to believe that it's possible also to reduce phantom limb pain with thermal feedback. Because at the end, you're bringing also sensory information to the brain. And anecdotically, we had one of our patients who had also phantom limb pain, which reported a relief during the test. So mm-hmm. when we were going with the warm one, we saw that. So we would like to check that in a clinical trial, like the proper, blinded experiment there. So that's one thing. There's another aspect that is also we did not mention, which is thermal comfort in the stump. Because the thermal regulation is sort of perturbed after the amputation, patients, they report a lot of discomfort inside the socket. So sometimes it could go extremely hot here. It doesn't sweat properly. And when it's cold outside, then it gets freezing cold. Like amputated arm is really cold and it's very uncomfortable. So we also think that trying to regulate the temperature there beyond the functional part could also help. So we also give the thermal regulation. That's where we would like to go. Now coming back on the more widespread use of that, as I was saying, it has to come from industrial. And I want to say something there that it's just want to add a little point there. I think there is a lot of conservatism from the industrials in that. I think they are a bit too used in their business as usual, we have noticed, and particularly with the big players. We have had a lot of interest from these younger companies that are being created now, where I think they have a better vision of what patients want. And we have been a bit disappointed by the conservatism from the industrial partners, which I think it goes into that famous quote. I don't know if it's true or if it's a made up quote of Henry Ford saying if I had to listen to the clients, I would just make faster horses instead of cars. It looks like there is a little bit going there where they haven't yet understood the importance of sensory feedback into prosthetics. So there is luckily some younger companies now coming into the market where are looking into the sensory feedback. If you ask the patients, they ask for it. They are interested by that. They would be ready to use it. And then comes the question of who pays for that extra technology. Something like this is relatively cheap, so maybe the it's a bit easier on that aspect. But realistically speaking of, let's say, a prosthesis with full sensation in the future will have a cost. And that part will become, that's where I would say this phantom limb sensation or those kind of things will become important also to make sure that, let's say, insurances and other stakeholders also will take their part paying for that.
So I had actually, speaking about, the costs. So I've seen this Wired video when Max Ortiz Catalan was speaking actually about the cost of his bionic hand. And he said it's like around $10,000 now. And of course saying like, the cost will go down when there will be more of it. So when there will be like more mass production or like basically more of them being manufactured. But you say that your part, this temperature part, is not that expensive. So it would be added on top of that and not adding the costs that much on top of that.
Absolutely. And now it would be probably marginal compared to the cost of a prosthesis. And also even the personalization, which is finding the right spots and making the whole, it's a few hours at the end, and just building the socket takes sometimes a week, so it's really marginal compared to the rest of it.
I'm just wondering, like, why we didn't even speak now? I mean, up until now about the bionic woman, and the Bionic Man and the $6 million man, yes. really, you know. So that was the cost, you know, back in the 70s in the movie yes. when they were speaking about, you know, creating the limbs from the beginning and like this $6 million figure was there. And like a lot less for a woman because the yes. parts were smaller, which is like, it doesn't make sense, does it?
right? Now, and it's interesting also that, excuse me, that was... The main description of that was the price of it rather than the very nice prosthesis. It's like, it costs $6 million. It seemed to be like the yeah. important part in the 70s.
If you have a lot of money, you'll have it yes. looking as your body yes. looked before, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's the fun part. Like, mm-hmm. where do you think this whole bionic thing is going? So what's the future? Is it about the cost? Is it about the new materials? Where are the opportunities, mm-hmm. maybe?
So what do patients want? Or, I mean, what they, let's say, they report in the studies? So they want something that is robust. Robustness is something that comes very often. So for those building like a robotic hand, making something that doesn't break, it's sometimes even more important than something extremely dexterous. So that's why the market penetration of some of the robotic hands with a lot of finger movements, but which breaks often have been less positive. They want something that there are two directions. I mean, I'm going to say something in its opposite. They want something that looks like a hand, but at the same time, there is much and much more now acceptance of something that does not look like a hand at all.
But works.
Exactly. And even actually, let's say making it look as little natural as possible is a trend. There are these examples for low limb mannequin who uses impossible legs, like legs made of glass, which are, and they look beautiful. They are really beautiful people with beautiful objects.
I've seen some of these, you know, arms, like this bionic or robotic arms, you know, and they look cool, you know.
Exactly.
They look much cooler than the one that we have here, you know, that tries to imitate the color of the skin because you can see, you know, it's not.
Absolutely. Right? No, absolutely. And I want to say that I don't want to also sound like it's going to go to a very robotic look, because at the end, it could be maybe as, I don't know, there are extrovert and introvert people. Maybe it's some people likes to hide it and look it's as more natural as possible.
Yeah, Fabrizio
likes this one. Mm. But then some other people say, no, I want to, it's to show my diversity. And it's something, it's a very strong actually movement there. Mm. We approach actually a designer, an artist who is in Cambridge right now. She's an artist, but also working in the laboratory with we have collaborated in the past, the one of Professor Tamar McKean, which works into impossible shapes. So for example, a lady with a tentacle instead of the hand, but a very beautiful one actually. And she's really working on those really limits of what a body should look like. So that's the on the aspect of that and on the functionality. Now on the sensory feedback part, it's again, it looks like looking into this newer companies who are, by the way, also getting a lot of attention and a lot of investment also. Many in the United States, a few also in Europe, it looks like that sensory feedback will become a big differential for the next generation of prosthesis, one that gives sensory feedback. Also, as I said, because it comes from the patients, and also because the technology now allows to do it by a marginal increase in the cost.
Just one thing, you know, because now patients are or can be more informed. So, I mean, even, you know, listening to a podcast, you know, can actually make a person, well, be an advocate for a solution that is not there. So that's kind of can start working from the bottom up.
Absolutely.
Towards the industry.
It's a very good point because probably so far the main voices were the one of the doctors and insurances and whoever had to pay at the end. But now there are solutions coming from the, I mean, I believe there has always been to some extent, but there is much more as you nicely say it, because people are more informed. There is, for example, one very interesting initiative on open bionics, so 3D printed bionics, so systems that are you could build by yourself. And there was one project for kids who have to change often their prosthesis.
Because they grow.
And there, instead of doing something that looks like a hand, they partnered with some artist and they make a Iron Man looking hand. So something with a little LED there. So the kid has, and he can also because it's 3D printed, it could be also done fairly simply by somebody by himself or by themselves, excuse me. So yeah, I mean the patient's voice is being heard in that, and hopefully for the sensory feedback, it would be also something to be heard, as it is something that they seem to care a lot about.
Solomon, so thank you very much for letting us into the world of the bionics, the sense of temperature. Actually, that's real fascinating. You know, how do we feel? How you can actually make the feeling in the hand that's not there, and basically the future of the neuroprosthetics. So thank you very much. And for you guys, if you want to, you know, see where's the project, please go to neuro-x.epfl.ch, which is neuro-x.epfl.ch. Thank you again.
Thank you.
I'm totally impressed by the audacity of researchers turned startup founders, doctors turned entrepreneurs, or ordinary parents turned healthcare innovators. People battling the battles that no one fought before for the extra health of the future. So if you see a startup posting on LinkedIn, show them some love, hit like, comment, that's fabulous. If you have a couple drops more of that altruism, follow the X-Health Show, leave a review here. I'll be able to bring more of these visionaries to you. So a big thank you. You're awesome. See you next week.
The information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered medical advice. If you have any medical questions, please consult your healthcare practitioner. The opinions on the show are Alex's or her guests. The podcast does not make any responsibility or warranties about guest statements or credibility. While the podcast makes every effort to ensure that the information shared is accurate, please let us know if you have any comments, suggestions, or corrections.